90-day pause. We're really just concerned with China, right? And it's like, you're just pulling this out of your ass now. Like, this is not to do with China. You just got spanked by the bond market.
Welcome to the Just Talk. I'm your host, Hami. We're now over 100 days into Donald Trump's second term as president, and his trade war with China is in full swing. Trump has imposed tariffs as high as 145% on Chinese goods. Trump and the Chinese have responded with retaliatory tariffs topping 125%. The results: rising prices for consumers, heightened geopolitical tensions, and deep uncertainty for American workers and industries. And joining us to unpack what this trade war really means for everyday people, who's winning, who's losing, whether this time Trump can in fact deliver the manufacturing comeback to the United States that he's been promising, is Dr. Mark Blyth, a man who needs no introduction. He's a political economist at Brown University, the author of Engronomics, and the author of the new book, Inflation, A Guide for Users and Losers. Dr. Mark Blyth, welcome back to the show.
It's good to be with you again.
Great to have you. Let's start with the big picture.
Okay.
Trump's argument is that China has taken advantage of the United States for decades through IP theft, trade imbalances, unfair industrial policy. And in response, his double down on tariffs, export controls, and reshoring subsidies. Now, how do you characterize Trump's trade strategy with China? Is this really about correcting unfair practices or something else? And then, can I tack on one more question on there?
Go on.
The tariffs are supposed to shrink the trade deficit, revive manufacturing, and discipline China. Is any of this actually going to happen? Has it happened?
Well, you've got all the questions loaded into one question, so we're going to have to unpack those a bit, right?
Yes.
As is usual with Trump, there's more than a grain of truth in what he says, but his way of then taking that grain of truth and turning it into a loaf of something else is quite extraordinary. So what's the grain of truth? Has China been taking advantage of us? All right. He says the same thing about Europe, right? Let's start there. Mm-hmm. In 2008, the European economies, the 21, I think it was at that time, that made up the European Union, basically had the same GDP as the United States, the same size. And Trump has said, quote unquote, that the EU is a put together to screw the US.
Right.
Over the past 15 years, the United States has grown 30% more than Europe. So if Europe's screwing us, it's a really weird version of screwing because we end up a third richer.
Right.
Now let's go to China, right? Are we being screwed by China? Well, to this day, around 40% of the exports that China sends to us are American firms that have decamped to China to take advantage of their labor costs and infrastructure and skills that we no longer have to sell us cheap stuff through Walmart. So the question of who's screwing who here is a little bit more complex, right?
Mm.
Now, the global imbalances story, this is where there's on firmer ground. So imagine the following. Mm. You go to New York and you look at that national debt clock and you go, Jesus wept, it's trillions, right? Mm-hmm. Now, the first thing is the national debt is actually the private sector's savings. These things are savings bonds. That's why people buy them.
Right.
You give the government money for 10 years, knowing that 10 years from now, you'll get the same amount back plus an interest payment, right?
Mm-hmm.
So if the United States is bankrupt and spending beyond its means, who are the people, who are the idiots on the other side of this that keep giving them money?
Right.
Well, that would be us, ourselves. The majority of bond purchases are actually just Americans. But a lot of it is China and East Asia. Well, why is that? Because they make stuff and we buy it because it's a transaction. We want their stuff, right? It's not exploitation. And then we pay them in dollars. Now, here's the thing, and this is the trick. You've got to pay attention here. If I'm one of those countries, I do not want to have dollars in my country because I don't use dollars. I use won in South Korea, renminbi in China. So should I just swap them one for one, right? I should take all the dollars around by my domestic manufacturers and go, here's the equivalent in won. Well, you see, if I did that, I've got a bit of a problem because they're doing quite well. And if they start getting all that money, then they might spend it. And if they spend it, prices in my economy would go up, wages would go up because people would be having a good time. And I don't want that because I'm a net exporter. That's how I make money in the world. And to be a net exporter, my stuff needs to be competitive. So if you go to any of these countries, you'll find that they save a hell of a lot. It's hard to get a mortgage. It's hard to get a credit card. You restrict people's consumption opportunities, investment opportunities. You could drive high savings rates. And what that does is it makes the stuff that you export cheap. So now you've got a problem. You've got a bunch of excess dollars. What are you going to do with them? Well, you just buy a treasury bill, because that treasury bill is guaranteed to come back to you in 10 years or 20 years or however long duration you want. And you get paid interest. So why would you not do that? Well, when you do that, what you're doing is you're handing the money back to the Americans that they just gave you to pay for the stuff that you sent them. And then they go, great, we'll take the money back. That's more money for us. That lowers our interest rates. We buy even more stuff from you. Okay. And that's why they end up with huge exports and we end up with huge deficits. One way to think about this, I think the correct way, is that their surpluses drive our deficits, not the other way around. Now, why is this a bad thing? Sounds like the best deal ever. For about 20 years it was. We got TVs, cars, computers, game consoles, drugs, whatever we wanted. And all we did was hand them digital bits of paper bearing 2%, which they then gave us back the money for. It was amazing, right?
Right.
Problem is, you run that for about 30 years and you begin to notice things. We don't make game consoles. We don't make drugs. We don't make electric cars. We don't do all the things that we're buying from someone else. And what's even scarier is we've completely lost the ability to do it.
Right.
Because the last time we did this was 30 years ago, before you were born. And that was the last time anyone in this country had the skills to do this stuff.
Right.
So you run this out for 40 years and you get to a point where eventually people might say, why are we keep accepting these digital payments? Because ultimately this economy doesn't make anything. There's nothing real behind it. So the imbalances story, this was something that was accepted by the Democrats. That's why they did the IRA in part, because they wanted to do Inflation Reduction Act to build new green sectors to reindustrialize that way. And what you get with Trump is an attempt to basically just put up really high tariffs on the assumption that if you make things expensive enough, every company will want to be in America. They'll shop, they'll set up shop, and then there'll be no problem with skills or anything like that, or mobility of labor, and everything will be great. We just do tariffs, that's it. And by the way, kill all the green stuff and just do carbon investments, because that's what all my states do, basically, in my coalition. So this is sort of like a realization that there's something there. And then, in my opinion, probably the worst, crappiest version of what to do about it.
That's a beautiful story you tell. There is so much gems in there. But as you were speaking, I was thinking about all of the TikToks that are coming from like China. And they're like,
oh, yeah, brilliant. All these sort of like overweight American workers, like doing garments really slowly. Yeah.
And then they're also like, this is my house. Tell me how many American goods are in my house. Right. Now you're American. Look at your house.
Yeah,
tell
totally.
Me how many Chinese goods are in your house.
That's right.
Fascinating. And to add a little bit more, to add a little bit of color on like the story you were telling. I read this book by Bennett Harrison and Barry Bluestone, called like The Great U-Turn, and how the American corporations radically restructured in response to global competition. Basically from like the end of World War II to the early 70s, working class Americans enjoyed rising wages, stable industrial jobs, and strong safety net. And then World War II ended, the Japanese, the Germans, all these other countries started.
Also, an important part of that story is very strong unions domestically. A lot of those factory jobs in places like Wisconsin didn't go straight to China. They went to Texas and other right-to-work states.
Right.
Then they went to Mexico. Then they went to China. This has been 40 years in the making.
Right. And so the story they tell is like, after when competition came, instead of improving products, firms slashed their sales. They engaged in union busting, relocating factories, and shifting products overseas. And Washington reinforced this shift through the Reagan administration by cutting labor protections, deregulating industries, and handing out tax breaks that rewarded offshoring. And the result has been a massive redistribution of wealth upward, the decline of manufacturing towns, and the
I agree
rising...
entirely. Is this a new book? I need to read it.
It's a bit old. I read it like my freshman year of college. Which feels like
no, I've heard the Barry stuff before, so I didn't know. I was wondering if it was a new one, but yeah, I completely agree with that. I think that's exactly what happened.
And so the question then remains: the era of mass industrial employment in the U.S. is it gone for good, or can Trump actually do this? Because you said at the end,
you're asking all the right questions, right?
Yeah.
So here's the thing: globally, The planet is deindustrializing. Get your head around that one, right? People aren't not jumping from China to Vietnam with the same quantities of jobs. Why? Because when you move and you've got to make those new investments, this isn't a time to upgrade. So what do you upgrade with? You upgrade with the latest tech. What's the latest tech? Robots, right? So basically your garment manufacturers, yes, there's still hundreds of women in a room stitching this sort of stuff, but you're beginning to see automation in those sectors, right? There's other places that could be alternate destinations like Latin America, but for various reasons to do with the volatility of their exchange rates and labor relations, et cetera, they just don't get the investment inflows. So they don't become the next big thing in manufacturing. And the whole sector essentially shrinking. Now, there's two stories here that need to be unpacked. One is, well, it's really just automation. That's all that's happened. And I think that that's wrong. The Bluestone story is very true. Automation's part of this, but absolutely decisions made by corporations to outsource, very, very important part of this, right? And it is also true that manufacturing is unique as a sector in that you can swap out capital, right? You can swap out machinery for labor really, really well, way better than you can do in the service sector.
Right.
So you're going to have that employment impact. Now, you put all this together, even if you had the holy troika of tariffs, a highly efficient developmental state, not the one that you're busy kneecapping with Doge, right? And a tertiary education sector that actually focused on the skills that you need as opposed to just degrees, right?
Yeah.
If you had all that and you then did this, you would create a lot more manufacturing. Would you create a nirvana of manufacturing jobs for millions and millions of Americans? I would be extraordinarily skeptical.
Right.
And a very simple reason why. What's the fastest growing by job by volume in the United States has been for the past decade and will be for the next decade?
You tell me.
Elder care nurse.
I would not have guessed that.
We're all getting older. All the boomers are ancient. They're going to live forever. So, or they're going to try. So where's your job growth going to actually come, right? Now, have you ever been in a factory? The thing about this thing about factories, right? You go talk to people that run factories and they're like, look, we try and make them as attractive as possible, but it's hot, it's sweaty, it's sometimes dangerous, it's loud, right? You could do that, or you could be sitting in a healthcare place like looking after a couple of people. Well, you're going to get paid less in that one. You have to get paid more. They're already paying $35 an hour, $40 an hour in some manufacturing facilities in the US, and they can't find workers because people don't want to do the work.
And so that was going to be my question, my next question. Do Americans want factory jobs back?
So, given those forces, right, you're going to employ as much capital as you can. You're just not going to get the employment bump that you want. And we don't have the Holy Troika. We are kneecapping our state and we're at war with our universities. So the idea that tariffs alone are going to produce this renaissance of manufacturing, I like to think of it as a kind of late boomer, late life fantasy, that what we can have is the economics of the 1950s, the social politics of the 1940s, and the imperial politics of the 19th century. And that seems to be sort of the imaginary of this project.
Yeah,
and you can't go back in time. Sorry, you just can't.
Speaking of the imaginary of this project, you know, you talk a lot about why understanding why people are attracted or believe stupid economic policies. Could you elaborate on why Trump has been so attractive in the United States? I mean, I don't know how attractive it is now. His poll numbers are way down, but at least he beat out Joe Biden.
Well, I mean, it's the beauty of simple economic ideas, right? They make sense when you think about them on an individual basis, right? So is it bad to save? No, of course it's not bad to save. What happens if everybody saves, nobody spends, and you create a recession? Duh, the paradox of thrift, right? What about trickle down? Yeah, it makes sense to give job creators even more money because then they'll invest more and then they'll create more jobs. Well, first of all, they don't invest. They take it as profits and then they get really rich and then they stop declaring income and then they no longer have income you can tax because they live off of loans that they get by pledging their assets and you just shrink the tax pool, right? So you take the next steps on these arguments. Now, it's similar with tariffs, right? Can tariffs usefully be applied to protect domestic industries? Yes. Can they be used to establish domestic industries? Yes. Are tariffs sufficient on their own to do that? Absolutely not.
Well, first of all, you just gave us so much free game on, you know, how to get rich and also hide your money and Anyways.
Oh, yeah, everybody knows that. Problem is, they say you need to be richer than you and I. You need to be at least 50 to 100 million to start playing those games. So, sorry, we're not here yet.
We're not there yet. And then I want to bring back from our last conversation that we had, check out that interview if you haven't seen it. Classic, Dr. Blythe. And so we talked about interdependence, right? And then Trump is always talking about dependent independence from China and its economic relation with them.
Yeah.
Is decoupling a fantasy, or is that something that they can actually do?
It depends on what you're trying to decouple and what your sectors are. Are there legitimate national security concerns for governments? Absolutely. Have they just wished those away for 20 years? Yes. I heard a comedian on the weekend say that the EU thought it could solve conflict through interpretive dance, but unfortunately, that's not true, right? And I think that's a nice way of putting it. At the end of the day, if you're dependent on Russian gas and Russia starts to do bad things and you can't get your helicopters off the ground and you can't even make your own helicopters, you might want to rethink your supply chains, right? Same with skills, right? If you don't do things, you're not going to have the skills to do things and you might need those skills in future. Or those skills will have payoffs in other sectors. And once you lose them, it's hard to get them back. So you want to have some degree of this. Now, here's your complication, right? You take a company like Ford or GM, it's an American company, but it builds certain cars or bits of cars in Mexico and it does others in Canada. The big three, which really globally aren't all that big at all, have effectively retreated to the home market of the United States. And it's a fully integrated auto complex whereby even if Ford wanted to buy its parts in the United States, it can't because they're made in Mexico, they're made in China, they're made in Canada, mainly in Mexico and Canada. So, can you reshore these things? Yeah, sure, but then you basically cost jobs and incomes in those places. Well, good, we're going to bring it home. How does it advantage the United States to make Canadian consumers poorer? Because they tend to buy American cars, right? It's all interdependent, right? So there are certain sectors where you would want to like do a little bit less of relying on everyone else. The pandemic also showed us why that was a bad idea. But basically, when it comes to it, the vast majority of trade and manufacturers, and we haven't even talked about services, which is the majority of the economy, right? But the majority of manufacturing trade actually takes place in intermediate goods, stuff that you use to make other stuff. And a lot of this stuff crosses borders several times. So you start tariffing this stuff, it just becomes ridiculously expensive.
Right. Speaking of expensive and speaking of tariffs, your new book, Inflation, A Guide for Users and Losers. I wonder if you give us a little bit of insight into that and help us understand who really pays the price in trade wars. Consumers,
Yeah,
workers,
sure. Let's
corporations.
take that as an example, right?
Yeah.
So the way we tend to think, this is why we wrote the book, me and my co-author Nicola Fraccaroli, right? Why did we write the book? Because the way we tend to think about inflation, if you've ever done an econ class, is not wrong, but it's drawn from the 70s. And it's this idea of too much money chasing too few goods, which basically means the government spent too much money. That also has a correlate in the labor market, whereby because there's too much money going around, people spend too much, demand exceeds supply, wages go up. Prices go up, wages go up, prices go up, you end up pushing up inflation. So these are the two mechanisms, right? When we saw the pandemic, none of those things applied. Now, people will say, but what about the Biden stimulus checks? Well, there was about 30 countries affected by inflation, and only one of them had Biden stimulus checks. So that just fails the sniff test right there. It might have been a unique contributor in the US case, but you can't explain it everywhere else. What about Europe? Europe's major problem was you suddenly ran out of gas. Right. So what's the policy response? Raise interest rates and look at the labor market. It's got nothing to do with that, right? So how does this work, right? So we decided to like focus on what was going on in the pandemic, which is, as we call everyone calls it, supply shocks. Literally, you can't get stuff. And the more you look into it, the more you realize that pretty much most inflationary episodes are supply shocks. Now, why does this relate to Trump, to tariffs? Because tariffs are what you'd call a policy-induced supply shock. You're making things more expensive, and that means that you will have less supply. That, by definition, is going to have an inflationary effect, particularly if you do it over a short period of time very aggressively, right? Now, we already know that, like, there used to be 60 sailings from China a month, and now there's down to like 30 or whatever the numbers are. That means there's going to be less stuff in Walmart. That means the stuff that's going to be there is going to be more expensive. Now, who gets hurt from this? This is the interesting part of this story. They often hear that we all suffer from inflation. No, we don't. And I'll give you two very simple examples of this, right? If you're in the bottom 60% of the US income distribution, then you probably don't shop at Whole Foods if you can help it. And if you're in the bottom 20%, you're absolutely going to Dollar General. If you're getting imports in those stores, which you do, and you get hit with tariffs, a 10% inflation on an income of 20 to 40,000, that means you and your family have to make serious decisions about what you want to consume.
Right.
It's really hard, right? If you're in the top 20% and you shop at Whole Foods, you don't give a crap about inflation because you're rich enough to shop at Whole Foods. If you're insane enough to spend that much on spring onions, then like you really don't care, right?
Right.
And the further up the income distribution you go, the more that effect attenuates. Why? Because what inflation basically is a tax on consumption. The reason we measure it with the CPI, the Consumer Price Index, is it's all about consumption. And if you've got little money, if you don't earn a lot, a huge percentage of your income goes towards basically buying consumption goods and also paying rents because you tend to pay rents rather than own your house. If you're at the top end of the income distribution, the richer you get, the less you spend on consumption, right? If I'm super rich, I can buy all the French champagne and fancy cheese that I want to just eat nothing but champagne and cheese for a week. And it's still less than 1% of my income. So how much of my income then gets hit by inflation? Much, much less. So this is why the poor are absolutely the ones that get screwed by inflation. And then the irony is that the people that voted for Trump, many of whom were not rich, are the ones that will actually feel the cost the most once this begins to filter through.
Basically, an attack on the poor once again, and
Yeah,
really
and you got
quite
to
really
wonder
quite
in this case,
yeah.
right? Is it a deliberate one in that sense? Or is it sort of like, yes, as they say in the administration, short-term costs, long-term gains? And they may actually believe that. I just don't think that they have the capacity to realize the long-term gains, given everything else we've spoken about.
Right. To move us a little bit, just a tiny bit, 2 years ago on this show, you told us that de-dollarization wasn't imminent because, in your words, the dollar is like Microsoft. It's not
Yep.
great, but everybody uses it. And you said that while there are countries like China, Russia, Saudi Arabia, who are frustrated with US financial dominance, there wasn't yet a viable alternative to replace it. And you told us that, like, there is no panic at the Treasury because they know that they got this in the bag and, for
Yep.
lack of better words, is this still the case today? Have recent developments with BRICS expansion, yuan trade deals, and US financial sanctions shifted the playing field in any way?
So there's a good book that just came out by Paul Bluestein called King Dollar, and it's written before Trump comes into power, and it deals exactly with. He has a chapter on each of those, and it's really good, and I believe him. And the answer is no. BRICS, why? Because ultimately, the BRICS can trade all they want with the BRICS, but they still trade more with the rest of the world. And the rest of the world doesn't really want to hold BRICS cash; it wants to hold dollars because that's what everybody else uses, right? Crypto. I mean, if you've been paying attention to what's been going on in the US with the Trump family and crypto, if you think that is a safe investment over a 10-year period, then please, I have a land deal in Florida for you, right? I mean, just forget it, right? All right. The real threat was the following: the Treasury market. So what happened was April 2, Liberation Day, where I was liberated from about 10% of my retirement funds. Thanks, Donald. When that happened, about a week later, basically the Treasury market began to poop its pants. Now, this is not meant to happen. The reason that we're able to do that trade that we spoke about over 30 years of people accepting dollars while we get computers and TVs, or rather dollar bonds, right, is because treasuries are meant to be, because they're so big, they're so deep, they're so universal, everybody uses them. They're what's called an information invariant asset, right? Now, it sounds techie, but like most things in this game, they only make it techie so that they can charge you more money. It's actually very simple. What it means is the Treasury is immune to whatever the news cycle says. It's not sensitive to the news cycle, right? So the Treasury price, supply and demand of a savings asset, doesn't matter who the president is, whatever, right? Donald comes in and basically says, tariff these islands that have penguins on them. And the whole world goes, you have no idea what you're doing. You're bonkers. And if you're bonkers, I need to start getting out of dollars. Now, there's two things going on here. There's a technical thing that hedge funds do called a basis trade. that's part of why you get this reaction. But even shelving that, you began to basically say to people, the Treasury is not information invariant. Okay. Trump can actually affect it. You don't really know what this thing's going to be worth over 10 years now. You don't even know if you're really going to get your money back, because in the Mar-a-Lago document, they're talking about 100-year bonds and people trading them. So suddenly this thing is now a risk asset, and it began to trade as a risk asset. Mm-hmm. Usually equities would do whatever they want. Bonds would trade in their own thing. They started to move in parallel. That's what you get with developing countries.
Mm-hmm.
So he managed, around the April the 9th, he managed to make the U.S. into a developing country bond market. Wow. And the yield started to go up quite precipitously. And that's when he went, 90-day pause. We're really just concerned with China, right? And it's like, you're just pulling this out of your ass now. Like, this is not to do with China. You just got spanked by the bond market.
Yeah.
Now, you know, having spoken to a couple of bond people about this, you know, there's two stories. One is, some of them are like, he screwed it, right? He's broken the Treasury market. Long term, everyone's now going to look for substitutes. And once everybody starts looking for substitutes, somebody's going to invent those substitutes. Changes, it's going to take a while, but he's basically made the shift inevitable. Now, pause for a minute, right? If you're Trump and your goal is reindustrialization, what do you want? You want a lower exchange rate for the dollar, less people to want the dollar, and you want less people to hold Treasury assets. Result, right? It might have been by accident, but it kind of goes with a plan, right?
Right.
Now, the second opinion is, even if that's happened, there's still such a lack of alternatives and a lack of trust in the alternatives, right? Do you really believe Chinese debt's any less information invariant? I mean, you're dealing with a Communist Party bond market. Why would you think that's any better? That ultimately, the liquidity and depth of treasuries, it doesn't matter. It's still information invariant. And you see this because over the past 2 weeks, things have kind of returned to normal. Mm. So the jury's out on exactly which one we're in. I think both are simultaneously true. I think he has broken it in the sense that people will now look for accelerated alternatives. Mm. But at the same time, it's going to be really hard to do that given the depth and scale of liquidity of the dollar.
Okay. I like to think about there. Last question.
Go on.
What do you think is the end game here, right? Because markets don't like trade wars or tariffs. I'm sure right. The Chinese are not thrilled about this. I'm sure the developing nations that are stuck in between are also not thrilled about this. The Europeans certainly are not thrilled about this. So
right.
What is the end game? Do you believe there's a master plan that Trump has here? Granted, I don't know who can read Trump's mind. Or is this ultimately about like political signaling, national identity, building something around him?
Well, I think, why do those have to be alternative projects, right? I mean, in a sense, there's a huge amount of improvisation going in here. It depends who's in the court of the king, who's out of the court of the king. Elon was in, now it looks like he's going out. They're doubling down on their war with Harvard. I mean, at the end of the day, does the American public really think this is the most important thing in the world? If prices really start to go up at the supermarket, he will pay a price. He's not immune to it.
Right.
I think my analogy for this is, if you go back to the New Deal, and you tell this, when you go to college now and you're a course on the New Deal, you'll hear a little bit about 1933, and it'll be about the setting up of the SEC and the Banking Act and this sort of stuff. And then it'll be how Roosevelt basically tried this thing called the NIRA and didn't work. And then they figured it out. And, you know, then you had Tennessee Valley Authority. And then you do these big projects, the Hoover Dam. And then World War II comes along. And then you've got the welfare state and that's it. And this is kind of seamless progression, right? And if we actually look at the actual history of this, right, the TVA was made possible by buying off the Klan. Right, I mean, that's what actually happened, right? The National Industrial Recovery Act was a disaster. The most frequent foreign visitor or foreign advisor in 1934 to the White House was Benito Mussolini's son, because they were looking at what Italy did with industrial cartels and company unions to try and figure out the way of the depression. That's what it looked like in 34. It's very different by the time you get to 35, 37, right. Social Security, unemployment insurance, whatever, right? So it takes a while for these things to evolve into whatever they're going to evolve to. So Trump could evolve into something that's actually more coherent, more sophisticated, etc. He could basically drop the tariffs to a lower level, but then keep phasing them in, basically saying to corporates, look, we're serious. You need to come home or you don't get to sell here, right? And then at the same time, you could stop beating up on your universities, or at least alternatively, invest in the ones that are going to give you the skills you want. HVAC electricians, sparkies, welders, right? The stuff that the skills that people need to make stuff, right? I just don't see these folks really doing it. I just don't see that really being the end game. What I see the end game on all this being is essentially they came in and punched the federal government in the nuts, and they went to war with the elites in the universities, and they made a lot of noise and various things. They put up tariffs and will declare that that was a victory, even if it's not. And they're going to take $1.5 trillion in tax cuts on the way out the door, whilst pretending to care about the debt and the deficit.
Wow. Dr. Blythe, as always, you're one of my favorite people to talk to and interview and also listen to on your own podcast. Thank you so much for coming back again on Let's Just Talk. I look forward to having these conversations again and doing this again.
Absolutely. Always great.